You are listening to Charmed City, a podcast about interesting people doing interesting things in and around Baltimore. We are here today with Evan Lutz, CEO and founder of Hungry Harvest. We are in their office space in Port Covington at the City Garage. Evan, what is this space that we're in right now?
Thanks for having me on the podcast. Yeah. I definitely appreciate it. City Garage has a lot of history here. So this used to be a place where trucks and buses used to get repaired from by the city. So you see these big open spaces. You got these 18 foot tall ceilings. You have, I think it's about a little over 100,000 square feet of space. And it's been through different owners over mm-hmm. over the years. Sagamore Development finally bought it probably about 5 years ago or so.
Okay.
And they outfitted it with a bunch of startups, a bunch of companies. They put Under Armour's doing some cool projects here where they're kind of trying to reinvent the supply chain management in this space called the Lighthouse over here. And we've got an open space, on the west side of the building right now. We've got about five to six companies in here right now, including Hungry Harvest.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And the Sagamore company, that's Kevin Plank's real estate development organization.
Exactly. Yep. And so they're really trying to revitalize this area. And City Garage was, actually, we've been in here about 3 years. We moved in May 2016, so we were one of the first tenants here. And
oh, that's great.
Free parking. It's 20 minutes away from our warehouse, and it's right off 95, and we're not paying that much here, so we really can't complain.
Great.
That's why we stayed here a few years.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's been pretty cool.
So obviously, as you guys grow, as Hungry Harvest grows, you're in different places across the country. Mm-hmm. So where are you? Where else are you located within Maryland? And then where else are you located? Outside of the DMV.
We have a facility in Jessup, good old Jessup, Maryland. About 25 and 30 employees in there. You got, I think about 25,000-30,000 square feet of refrigerated space. We also deliver up to Detroit, Philly, Baltimore, obviously Baltimore, D.C., Raleigh, and Miami. So we've got a couple employees in Miami, a few in Raleigh, a few in Detroit, a few in Philly.
That's awesome.
So kind of spread all out. Yeah.
You're really seeing growth. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, appreciate it.
So for those who might not know what Hungry Harvest is, I feel like I probably should have asked that first, but what is Hungry Harvest? What are you guys doing here? And let's just start there.
Yeah, we're a produce delivery service on a mission to fight food waste and hunger. So the food system is fundamentally broken. It's been broken gradually and steadily over the past, I want to say, 40 or 50 years, caused by a couple of reasons, and to a place where it is today, where we've got basically 40% of everything we grow doesn't make it to human consumption, right? It goes to waste, right? And it's staggering statistics, and I can go on and on. 20 billion pounds of produce go to waste every year. We're using about 9% of the total landmass of the United States every year to grow food that nobody eats, right? It's the size of New Mexico, pretty crazy. So what we figured out is a lot of this produce that goes to waste is actually really good, is really healthy, is really nutritious, just looks a little bit different, or it's surplus. Or a buyer will cancel on a farmer, and they'll be stuck with their product. And so there's all these reasons why it goes to waste, not because it's bad, right? And so we figured out that we can pay farmers a fair rate, but below market rates, right? So they're getting a return on their money. We're getting a better price on the products. Deliver it to our customers and deliver it to them for a lower cost than they would receive at a grocery store. And then for every box we deliver to a customer, to an individual, these are e-commerce website, where people sign up for a weekly subscription. For every box we deliver through that subscription, we also help somebody in need eat healthy through either a donation or a subsidy. So we're really trying to, at the core of what we do a couple things, right? We move produce from one place to the other. We buy it from farms, distribution centers, move it to customers' homes, and move it through our different channels. And the second thing is we're trying to educate people on why the food system is the way it is and how we can go about fixing it. And we think we have a really kind of simple solution with complicated execution, to say the least. And we've been here, actually today is on the date that we're, doing this interview is our fifth birthday.
Oh,
so 5 years.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, we're doing this half a decade, so it's pretty
cool.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Pretty cool to think about, yeah.
So a lot of the produce that you're getting is basically like slightly blemished produce. Is that correct, or how does that work?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's, you know, to a normal consumer, this is kind of glad you asked this question, because this is kind of what we're doing, trying to do in terms of educating people. Mm-hmm. Is food waste exists in many, many different forms. When you think of food waste, you think of like produce that's in the trash or like going bad or moldy. When I think of food waste, I think of, you know, pallets upon pallets of produce that are really fresh, that are sitting in a warehouse somewhere or just got harvested and don't have a buyer, right? Or acres and acres of a field that, you know, the number two produce, I'm using air quotes here, have been left behind because, the green peppers got a little too ripe and had some red striations. They call them suntan peppers, and that's the reason why they wouldn't get harvested. Or apples grow with some scarring because they brushed up when there was a big windstorm when they were young, and so they were light. They brushed up against the tree, and they got scarring, and, you know, there's no dent, there's no bruise, it's not rotting, it's just literally the outside of the apple. It's not necessarily blemished or bad produce. It's a normal consumer's eyes. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between anything that you buy from us, anything you buy at the grocery store. For example, a crooked carrot. You know, if you see a row full of straight carrots at the grocery store, you know, we go down the grocery store aisle and you see everything's lined up shiny, the same size, the same color, the same shape. And produce doesn't grow all like that, right?
No.
So if you put a crooked carrot in a row of straight carrots, probably people aren't going to pick out the crooked carrot. But if you put just two crooked carrots in a box, you don't have anything to compare it to, right? So for consumers, it's really... they think their box is going to arrive and it's going to be all this ugly produce, but it's really just a box of produce, right? It's not pretty. It's not ugly. It's just produce. It's how it grew on the farm. So that's kind of our pitch to consumers. Yeah. It's like, it's not bad. It's not rotten. It's not ugly. It's produce. Otherwise wouldn't find a home. So give it a good old home.
Well, I love that. So I asked the question from like an ignorant standpoint, so it's good.
No, it's
that
all,
you know,
good, man.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure you get those questions a thousand times a day.
Like I said, this is kind of core of what we do, is like, one is move produce from one place to the other, two is educate consumers. Mm-hmm. So we're happy to do it.
Yeah, well, thank you. So what type of products, like, what's your, like, what do you offer consumers? Because obviously you could collect all this stuff, you collect fruits and vegetables, and then you deliver it, but I know there's different tiers and different versions. What are the products?
So everything's demand driven, right? So we have tons of data on what our customers like, on the types of produce they don't like. And so we build our boxes based on that, and we can go out and find the supply, which we can do, you know, most of the time. So each box comes with between like 7 to 10 different items, 7 to 8 to 10 pounds of produce, you know, one leafy green, typically 2 to 3 types of fruits, 3 to 5 types of vegetables. And you can customize your box, so you can choose more of what you like, less of what you don't like. So, for example, in this week's mini harvest, which is, you know, starts at $15, we have acorn squash. I don't really like acorn squash or winter squash that much, so I customized that out and added in, I think I added in like oranges or something like that. So then we have organic boxes as well. We have all fruit boxes. We have all veg boxes. We also have different add-ons. So we have bread, we have eggs, we have a bunch of different pastas and stuff like that you can add on, typical kind of grocery store items. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, you can do a lot of grocery shopping with Hungry Harvest, and it comes in a weekly or bi-weekly subscription. You can pause or cancel at any time. That's pretty much the product.
That's awesome. Yep. I feel like the subscription model just in general is growing and growing.
Yeah. I mean, we really, you know, and that's on purpose. We might be, I don't know if we'd sell more boxes of just one time purchases, but, you know, part of our mission is, if we're going to try and really fight food waste, it needs to be consistent, right? And so we want to get in the habit of people's lives of, like, you know, eating produce every single week and supporting this solutions to kind of this broken food system. So we didn't really want to do one-time purchasing. We thought that was kind of generic. We didn't think it was really that genuine. So we wanted to make sure that people are, like, really into this and passionate about food waste and have a usable product, right?
It's also a pretty, like, niche market to get into, understanding the food waste problem, understanding that there is this this issue with the produce being maybe just, like, a blemish on the produce. How does someone like you, like, 5 years ago you were in college, how did you figure this out, and how did you turn it into you know, Hungry Harvest as we know it today?
Yeah, I definitely haven't figured out anything yet.
Okay.
I would make the argument, but I've, you know, tried to, I just have a kind of exploratory mind, so I'm very curious about things, and as long as I can remember, I won't say that, that's a little extreme statement. When I was like 12 or 13, I can remember being really interested in social entrepreneurship, right?
Okay.
Which is different than I've ever heard. So I've always been interested in business and making impact. And I heard about these business models where you're aligning incentives that, you know, traditional businesses don't have. Okay. So I'll give you a couple real world examples. So Coca-Cola, right? They make
right.
products. They make a profit off that product.
Mm-hmm.
It's their every right to do. And then they, you know, use some of that profit to build drinking wells in Africa for rural communities, right? Doing great work. But there's inherently an inverse incentive there, right? Because the more wells they build in Africa, the less profitable they'll be, right? They're taking away from profit. It's a trade-off, right?
Yeah.
I'm interested in the models of like, okay, so how can you increase profitability and impact at the same time? So you're not doing any kind of trade-off. So the more you sell, the more impact and profit you make. It's not, you're not trading off one for the other.
Right.
And so I studied business at Maryland for a senior year project for a social innovation fellows class. There was a farmer that came and presented to our class, and he told us about this 20 to 30% of his produce that he goes to waste every single year. He told us about the entire food industry. I knew nothing about this before that kind of presentation.
Mm-hmm.
I knew food waste was a thing, but even in, you know, this was in 2013 when he presented. Food waste wasn't nearly a hot topic like it is today.
Yeah, I feel like
right?
It's everywhere now. Yeah.
It's everywhere. It's being talked about by every single media outlet has done multiple stories on how big food waste is and climate change and all of that stuff and food insecurity. 2013, none of those articles existed, right? And so this farmer was trying to sell his produce to college students. He was like, I just want to minimize my waste and make an extra buck. It's like, okay, that makes sense. So I can buy this produce from dirt cheap to you, sell it to college students for dirt cheap. And you know, try and build a sustainable model to reduce food waste. And so I was the kid that was you know, people were like going to class, and I was like hauling like 50-pound bags of onions like downstairs and stuff. I got a bunch of weird looks. It was definitely not a cool thing to do. Like it was like, you know, people were at that time, like startups in college are much bigger thing today. They're really big today.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2013, they were still like on the rise. So like people were starting like, you know, tech startups and healthcare startups and e-commerce and all B2B startups, software startups, all these cool things. Nobody was getting into food.
No.
Right? Absolutely nobody was getting into food. So I was just selling one farmer's produce. I looked at myself after like 1 week where we made like 10 sales. I was like, what am I doing? Like, is this really gonna work?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the weather got nice. I started in like January, and the weather got nice in like March, and we stood outside a Stamp Student Union, at Maryland, where there's a lot of foot traffic, and slowly we got, you know, 20 people to come, and 30, and then 50, and then it was 100, and then by the end of the semester in April, May, we had about 500 customers per week, right?
Wow.
So I was selling 5-pound bags for $5. And if you do the math real quick, that's a $2,500 a week business, $100,000 a year business.
Uh-huh.
In the matter of 6 months that I built, just selling one farmer's ugly produce.
To just the University of Maryland, basically.
To just students. That's right. And so you ask, you know, how do I figure it out? Well, I didn't figure out anything.
Right, right.
All I did was start and sell produce. And I realized, okay, I went back to this farmer and I said, okay, so how much on those peak weeks, like how much produce... how much surplus produce did you have and how much did I sell? He said, you sold about 10% of
wow.
all the surplus produce
yeah.
I had, right? So I knew this was really scalable.
Mm-hmm.
I started to study the statistics. I started to talk to other farmers, realized this is a huge, 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 huge deal. Nobody was talking about. And so I went off on a campaign to, you know, try and solve this issue. I knew nothing about food, knew nothing about produce, knew nothing about logistics, management, hiring interns, paying wages, insurance, starting a website, nothing. Like none of that
right.
I had previous experience on, and you kind of have to figure it out. And so it's been, it's definitely been a journey, and it's been a lot of fun. You know, I do, forget if I'm going on too much a rant.
No. I mean, this is kind of like the reason we're here talking to you because,
yeah.
you know, this business is so unique and so, you
yeah.
know, specialized. I want to hear about, this is what we're here for.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm very pro entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And especially with, actually, it doesn't matter what age. I actually respect people that are in their 50s and 60s going into entrepreneurship way more than I do college students. Because people in their 50s and 60s often have a mortgage, a family, and they're quitting a full-time job. And
much more to lose in that scenario.
A lot more to lose. When I was a college student, I could live at home and not take a salary for a couple of years and, like, you know, generally be okay. But so I give this talk to a lot of, I talk to a bunch of colleges and universities. I say, I want to make entrepreneurship a lot more accessible than it seems. And I think the way to do that is actually by not looking at Steve Jobs as a role model or an idol. And here's the reason why. It's because once you look at Steve Jobs as a role model, then you expect to be him.
Right.
When that's only like, you know, it's like asking like, you know, an average basketball player, like, you know, you can be Michael Jordan when they probably can't.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that person contained a really, really high skill set. And to replicate what he did and do all of that is very inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
So my message to students, to people that want to be entrepreneurs, is like, you don't really have to be that skilled, right? You don't have to have all these years of experience. You don't have to have domain expertise in a certain area. You just have to want to try it, right? And be curious and have the right mindset about it and figure it out on the way. And if you really want it, you know, bad enough, if you think it's your calling and you're not going to give up after 6 months, after you've burned through 50K and people have shut the door in your face and, you know, and you haven't gained much traction. If after that you're not going to give up, then I'd say give it a try. If
right.
you think like in 6 months or a year, and you've been shut down by every avenue, and you haven't raised money, and you haven't gained a single sale, and you're going to give up after that, it's probably not for you. But if you can look at that situation and say like, okay, I'm gonna push on through that, yeah, then definitely get into it.
And I think that those are, I mean, obviously that's great. And I think that one aspect of like being from the area in which we're from is that like you see someone like Kevin Plank who had that, you know, I'm going to do this in college and I'm going to work through it and I'm going to create this scalable business.
That's right.
You look at him as the example and you're like, okay, so this is an achievable thing to do.
That's right. Yeah, and Kevin Plank still makes mistakes. He admits them.
Yeah,
right? And I think that's the mentality to have. Right? Is like you see CEOs of large businesses that started them. Like Kevin Plank is a great role model for young entrepreneurs. I think because he started from scratch in college. He didn't have any experience or domain expertise in fabric. He didn't know anything about design or fashion or patents. He talks about this stuff all the time, and yet he grew a multi-billion dollar business and public company, still makes mistakes, still tries to learn from them, and still pushes forward. And like that's the kind of person you want to look up to, is somebody that started from scratch, makes mistakes, learns from them, and is going to move on. It's not perfection.
Yeah,
because we're not trying to be perfect out here.
No, and I mean, yeah. I love to hear that, and I think that really will probably resonate with a lot of people. So one thing I wanted to quickly just like go back to a little bit is obviously you went to the University of Maryland.
Yep.
And that's where the company started, but you know, you grew it and you made it what it is today in Baltimore. What is it about Baltimore that attracted you, or why are you still kind of HQ'd here in Baltimore City?
Great question. I'm really, really passionate about this. So Baltimore is my hometown. You know, I'm born and raised just outside the city and technically in the county. But, you know, I consider Baltimore my hometown. And growing up, I was like, you know, I mentioned before, I'm really interested in impact. Mm-hmm. I've been interested since I was in middle school in creating a difference in the world. And Baltimore is like, it has so many systematic issues, so many problems in this city that's, you know, at a young age, I didn't know how to solve. Like, I volunteered all the time at Our Daily Bread and Maryland Food Bank and a bunch of different places when I was a kid. I remember, like, thinking, like, this isn't enough for me. Like, I like volunteering, and I think you get really good impact and you get give back from it, but I always wanted to, like, make impact on a bigger scale, right?
Right.
And actually really solve Baltimore's issues. And I knew volunteering wasn't going to be just enough, right? And I still volunteer to this day, and it's, I think it's great, but looked at like the hunger in the city and the disparity. I mean, you got neighborhoods that are a mile apart where the life expectancy is like 12 years, right? And you look at Mount Vernon and go a mile west and into Sandtown, Winchester, and the life expectancy is like 10 years apart or something.
Wow.
Something crazy, right? So I have always been really passionate about this city. It's always been in my mind. Like, I had no question. I had no dreams of going to San Francisco or Austin or Portland. Like, I think, like, that's like to me, that's like inauthentic bullshit from startups.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think authentic startups are going to Detroit, or going to Baltimore, or going to Raleigh, or going to cities that, like, you know, actually need the jobs, need the economic growth,
mm-hmm.
need the difference to be made there. And no matter what you're doing, you don't have to be running a social enterprise, but just by putting your business in a city that really needs it, I think that it in itself is inherently helping out the city,
yeah,
right? a ton,
yeah, for right? sure.
And so Baltimore's always been in my heart. Especially with food. So, you know, we didn't really have a headquarters for the first couple of years of the business. I was working at home. We were working out of Starbucks and libraries and whatnot. And the goal was ever, dream was always come back to Baltimore, create a bunch of jobs here, create a bunch of impact in the city, and create a well-known brand. And I think we're on the way to doing that. But really, it's about the impact. I mean, you just got, you know, I can go on and on all day about Baltimore. We just have neighborhoods that have just been completely looked over by nonprofits, by for-profits, by the government, both intentionally and unintentionally.
Yeah.
And you got the wrong kinds of economies going into a lot of these neighborhoods, and it's a real travesty. Like, I think Baltimore has a lot of complex problems. There's no silver bullet. I think one potential solution that we're working on is by, filling food access gaps. But basically, you know, I mentioned before that for every box we deliver, we help somebody need it healthy through donation or subsidy. So we've got this program called Produce in a Snap,
mm-hmm.
where we're selling our bags, basically reduced cost, at cost, in neighborhoods of high food insecurity.
Oh, wow.
And you look at, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You've got, you know, kids that are, you know, where we're sitting today in Port Covington, just across the street, Hanover Street Bridge, about a half mile away. You've got kids that have never tasted a strawberry before, right? Or you know, have an apple once a year,
mm-hmm.
right? And just don't have access to healthy food. And it's amazing the kind of positive externalities that can happen when you introduce healthy food to a community or to a person, right?
Right, yeah,
Look at that Maslow's hierarchy need. What is it? Food, safety, shelter is like the number one thing. You know, self-enlightenment or something is the top. If you don't have to worry about food, or you know you have access to food, then all of a sudden, like, so many opportunities will open up. You can, you know, work on school or work on getting a job. You don't have to worry about feeding your kids. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know that you have food at home. Like, that is such a worry. I mean, if you just put yourself in somebody living in a food desert's shoes, that doesn't, you know, that's living on fixed income, it doesn't have access to healthy food, just, like, put yourself in your shoes for a second and say, like, okay, say you're going home from work and you know you don't have any money to spend on food and there's no grocery store or restaurant within walking distance. What do you do? Think about that every single day,
right?
How are we supposed to be a productive society when we've got, you know, 140,000 people that are living like that in Baltimore out of 600,000.
So quickly, I just want to clarify some things just so that we have, like, a basis understanding for some of the things that you're talking about. What is food insecurity, and what is a food desert?
Yeah, good clarification question. So food desert, actually the Baltimore City renames these areas healthy food priority areas. So basically a food desert is where it's low income, there's no grocery store within walking distance, not a lot of people have cars or public transportation. So basically there's no way to get accessible healthy food, healthy produce. Food insecurity is where basically you don't know where your next meal is coming from. We sort of define it, that's the way USDA defines it.
Okay.
We sort of define it like if you don't have access to healthy food, like there's nothing within a geographic distance that mm-hmm. you can get healthy food, or you can't afford healthy food. So say, there's, if you look at Johns Hopkins has put together this, the Center for Livable Future has put together this great map of all the food deserts across Baltimore City. And there's these little pockets in impoverished neighborhoods because there's a grocery store in there. But actually the grocery stores in some of these neighborhoods, because they're the only competition in town that actually jack up prices.
Mm.
So you can buy cheaper produce in the county where there's five grocery stores in, you know, mile radius than you can in a food desert. And so we still consider people that are living in an impoverished neighborhood, even if there's a grocery store there, It's, you know, that's still, people are living in food insecurity because they can't afford, even though they have access to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, yeah, I mean, that's super interesting. I don't think the average person would, you know, recognize that those issues are like systemic within a community, or even obviously people know that there are issues within Baltimore, but I don't necessarily know if food is the first thing that someone might think of when they think of like, you know, systemic problems within a community. So it's great to hear that you guys kind of have set up this coinciding, you know, for-profit yeah. with, you know, yeah. some more socially conscious efforts. And I think there's an overall shift in like socially conscious business that we've seen in our lifetime. And it's yeah. great to see that like you all are a part of that, and that you're not only helping Baltimore, but you're helping with this, like from like an education standpoint, and sharing that message, you know, around, you know, the nation.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, food is, to your point, you know, when people think of Baltimore's issues, they don't think of food first. Mm-hmm. And it's because food is not a sexy issue, right? Nobody's going to run on a platform of food,
right?
You know, run on crime reduction or drug reduction or homelessness reduction or better schools.
Because those are things you can see.
Right. But actually, you know, when people are hungry, when people don't have food, Anthony Bourdain is one of my heroes and role models. And, I was listening to him on a Joe Rogan podcast actually a couple of days ago, and he was talking about what's the most dangerous situation he's ever been. And he said, you know, when you've got mass amounts of people that are impoverished and hungry, people act like hungry people do, right? And
mm-hmm.
and so we don't, when you have a society, 140,000 people, right? That's, you know, a third, a fourth, I can't do the math in my head. You know, 140,000 people out of 600,000 people that are going hungry every day or not getting the right kinds of food, have to constantly worry about food. You know, what if you could, like, let's ask ourselves a simple question. So what if we reduce that by half? What if it was, you know, 20,000 people, right? And still that's not good, but it's better than, you know, the percentages that it is today. Like, how many of those people would be able to get jobs? How many people would not have to go to the hospital once a week to go to see the doctor? How many of those kids would feel comfortable, you know, feel more confident because they can stay awake during school and
right.
not crash because they're having a sugary breakfast, nothing for dinner the night before, and be able and feel motivated to go to college. You know, these are things that in my eyes are like directly related. Food might not be a sexy issue, but it's important. Everybody eats three times a day. It's a huge, or needs to eat three times a day, mm-hmm. right? It's a huge, huge, huge issue. And that's why I'm really passionate about it, particularly in Baltimore, because again, there's so many problems in the city. And I think, well, food is not the silver bullet. There's almost nothing that is. If we can fix some food access gaps for some people, I think we'll be doing something good.
I think it's great that you kind of fell into this specific form of you know, social entrepreneurship with food. Like as yeah. you mentioned previously, you hadn't thought about it until you were you know, a senior in college. That's, you know, what, 22 years of life without being like, you know what problem I want to solve? Food, right?
Right.
But
right.
It kind of sounds like it was like the right place, right time type of thing. And you kind of
totally.
Have like that light bulb moment. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's actually, it wasn't, you know, I also want to, this is something I always say to college students as well. Who want to become entrepreneurs, there really is no light bulb moment.
Okay.
Right? It's not like I just thought of, oh, I'm going to solve food waste, you know, and hunger in the shower or something. And like just thought of this genius idea. No, it kind of, like you said before, it kind of like just fell into my lap and it was like just working. And so I was like, okay, this issue might be solvable through business. Let's test some assumptions. Let's go after some markets. Let's learn about some things and kind of went from there.
So a lot of learning went into
so much. Yeah, I learn every day. I mean, it's learning. Learning is you know, people are lifelong students. I consider myself one of them. I've never been a classroom learner. I learned more in the 6 months I was running the pilot program for Hungry Harvest than I did in the previous 4 years of school at Maryland.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
it just you know, my brother was always the good academic. I was always the out of classroom learner. But yeah.
So I feel like Port Covington is going to change a lot in the next couple of years.
Mm.
You know, with Kevin Plank's he got approval for some crazy developments in this area. Do you think that will change how your organization runs or what you're able to do?
I think it will present more opportunities. You know, if it does happen, we're hoping it does. You know, I think it'll bring, you know, good business into the city, and you know, it'll be generally positive for everybody. I mean, there's some negative feedback out there about, you know, affordable housing and whatnot not being included in the plan, but I think generally, you know, we can't have everything. You know, generally it's gonna be a positive thing. In terms of Hungry Harvest, I mean, it's always better for startups to be around other startups, right?
Okay, yeah.
I go to a lot of different roundtables for, you know, local CEOs in the city and local business owners and startup owners and whatnot. And I always say this is like, if we don't help each other, nobody will, right? No investor is going to come down and just start writing out checks, handing out checks.
Yeah.
It's up to the entrepreneurs to develop an ecosystem ourselves. And that's the thing is, you know, entrepreneurs in Baltimore particularly, we love to complain, per se, about the lack of a startup ecosystem here.
Right.
And my point is always, well, the ecosystem is what we make it.
So make it better.
So make it better. And the way we start by that is by helping each other out. Mm-hmm. So anytime we can interact with more business owners, more companies, with more startups, with more just general business, right, and more organizations, the better in my eyes. So Port Covington in general is positive. I don't know exactly tangible things it's what it's going to do for us, but I just know that being around more people is better.
And when you attend these events, these roundtable events, these you know, startup CEOs, where do you typically find yourself in terms of like the age range? Like, are you typically still on the younger side of things?
Typically, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm generally still the youngest person at events or one of the youngest. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm 26. I started this business, so I guess I was 21. But there's a lot of founders that are in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Like I said, I respect them a lot more actually than young founders, because not that I don't respect young founders, but, you know, if you're leaving a job or if you have a mortgage or if you have, if you have a husband, you have kids, like moms as entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Whew. I don't know how the heck they do it.
Yeah, because yeah.
I'm an entrepreneur. I don't have kids. I'm not a mom. And I have a really tough time, right? It's really hard. So moms and entrepreneurs, I have like the utmost respect for as like a breed of people.
Right.
They're I know some moms that are entrepreneurs that are just badass. They're pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've been, you know, exposed to tons of really interesting and outstanding and incredible people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been pretty cool. I mean, I think, you know, one of those, I forgot who says this quote, but a lot of people say this quote, but it's like, you know, make your friend group and the people you interact with aspirational, right? So, like, you don't want to hang out with people that are, you know, like that are lazy, or people that are like going to bring you down, or get bad influences on you. You want to hang out with people that really are going to push you and challenge you and bring you to the next level. And especially in business circles,
mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, I'm part of a number of groups and societies. One's called Shift Society, where, you know, it's a local group of CEOs that we all challenge each other once a month and get together and do really cool business and leadership things. So hanging around that group of people, it's really inspiring. I definitely encourage entrepreneurs. I get asked a lot, like, how do you get more involved in, you know, the Baltimore startup ecosystem, whatever, you know, I think it's just about picking up the phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the greatest things that entrepreneurs can do to help out ecosystems is actually pick up phones for students that want to be entrepreneurs, right, and help them out. And you guys can hear Roxy. This is my dog. Hey, Roxy. Knew you'd make an appearance. If you pick up this phone for student entrepreneurs, they'll become entrepreneurs. You'll be networking for life. So I always recommend network as much as you can. Make real relationships. People don't just get coffee and just talk about general, generic things. Like, you know, get beers with people. I'm a beers guy instead of a coffee guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that goes a long way with making relationships that are really lasting, you know?
Yeah. I think the quote's something like, surround yourself with the people you want to be, not the people that are just like you.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Something like that. And I think that runs true in building a team and building a network and building an ecosystem.
Yeah.
It's very, very true. And if you get people to challenge yourself and hold you accountable, like, that's, you know, you're just going to see better results from yourself and from your business,
right,
in my opinion.
That's, yeah, I mean, that's an amazing, that's an amazing way to look at it.
Yeah.
And I think that's obviously the correct way to look at it. And it's a sustainable way to, you know, create a business.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of want to swing back to like the origins a little bit of Hungry Harvest.
Yeah.
So I know that you guys won, what was it, the Cupid's Cup? Is that what it's called at Maryland or something like that?
Well,
or?
We were in the Do Good Challenge, came in third place for that. We've won Light City. That's a business competition here in Baltimore. And then we won Beta City, I think, last year, 2 years ago or something like that.
So you've won a fair bit of, like, competitions and whatnot.
I think a couple, something like that.
Is that where you got, like, your initial round of funding, or how did you go about, you know, obviously you're 21 years old.
Yeah.
Who's trusting you with, you know, thousands of dollars to start your business?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we always self-funded at first. I mean, the first check didn't come in until, you know, we were 8 months after we started. And by that point, we were doing like 40K or 30K in revenues per month, which was, you know, which was something, but not enough to pay people. So right. We had a little bit of traction there when we first got our first dollars in. I think if we were just getting started and had no money and just say, hey, we have this idea. This is back, you know, in 2013, 2014. I don't think anybody would have wrote us a check. So
right.
We got our first funding. I put, you know, basically my life savings from just, you know, to caddying a bunch of summers and whatnot into the business. And that's how we paid our first interns. But we got accepted into this cohort, this business accelerator called the Conscious Venture Lab, a mission-driven accelerator based in West Baltimore. So we were in cohort number two for them. They wrote us a 25K
check.
And then we did a friends and family round. We got another 20K in that summer. And then we were on Shark Tank, raised money through that. And after Shark Tank, our business kind of quadrupled overnight.
I wonder
and,
why.
yeah, it was pretty cool. It was, you know, shown in front of 8 million people. Definitely accelerated our rate of growth. And we were able to raise 500K off of that. And then, so total, we raised around $1 million or so. It's been from angel investors. We haven't ever taken institutional capital. Not that I'm against it, but, you know, we want to choose our partners wisely. And I feel like everybody that's written a check into Hungry Harvest has added value and believed in our mission. And I want to be really careful on who we bring onto the cap table.
Yeah, I mean, you're being socially conscious. You might as well be conscious about the money that's coming in. So I totally respect that.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought up Shark Tank. Obviously, I was going to have to bring that up.
Sure.
That's like, I mean, you're the only person I know who's ever been on Shark Tank. I don't know if you're the only person ever from Baltimore to be on Shark Tank. But
no, there have been a few. There have been a few companies that are on from Baltimore. I think there's one, well, not, maybe not from Baltimore. I think we were the first company from Baltimore, but there's one from Tacoma Park. There's one from Columbia, a couple of places. I actually know a couple of people in Baltimore that were on Shark Tank that didn't get aired.
Oh, right? Really?
Yeah, which is a thing. It's a
really I'm sure.
Thing. So the way Shark Tank works is 45,000 companies apply. They fly out like 160 to go film. They only film 140 because you have to do this kind of audition in front of producers, the day before you're about to film. And actually, that's really intimidating because if you screw that up, like, they won't even film you, which is really intimidating. They actually air like 120. So we were lucky that we got chosen to air. Filmed in June 2015, aired in January 2016. And it just, you know, our team size was about 4 people at the time when it aired. Raised a little bit of money, grew it to 11 people, and then kind of screw the business from there. And today we're about 51 people.
Wow.
So,
Well, so when did that, like, when was that seed planted in your head to be like, you know what, maybe we could be on this show? Or like,
I mean, it was always a dream to go on it.
Right.
I never thought it was realistic. Right. I mean, so Shark Tank actually reached out to us. They had heard about our idea through, I think it was like a friend's dad friend. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was like a Six connection or something. Reached out to us. They told us the whole application process. They were very unlikely to get chosen. There's a very long handwritten application. It's like 50 pages. You got to make an 8-10 minute video. Very time intensive. And it was like, we were like, no thanks. And so we hung up the phone and About 3 months later, they contact us again and say, "Hey, we really want you guys to apply." And we're like, "Okay, maybe they want us to.
Yeah,
maybe we got a shot here." So we filled out the application and made a video, which actually, surprisingly, I just checked it the other day for some reason. It has like 10,000 views. Our application video on Shark Tank.
Oh, it's still on YouTube.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. You can go check it out. We made it in literally an afternoon. It was really stupid, but that's what they want. They want like characters. They want people that are entertaining, and so that's kind of what we went for. And we just wrote down like. So just wrote things that I thought were going to be funny and explained our business. And so then, you know, we went on to the next round, made another video, got more, you know, questions and applications and whatnot. So finally in June, early June of 2015, they gave us a call and said, "Hey, guess what? Flying out to go see Shark Tank."
Wow.
And so we, you know, I watched between then, it was like about 3 weeks between I got that call and going out to film. And so in those 3 weeks, our entire business was focused on Shark Tank.
Yeah, I could imagine.
I watched every single episode of Shark Tank. I'm not being facetious there. Literally, yeah. Every single episode of Shark Tank. Wrote down every question that's ever been asked.
I was going to say, you probably took crazy notes.
I should probably sell this as like a book. It's like 70 pages or something. I literally have every single question that's been ever asked on that show, right? And we wrote down answers. Every question, rehearse them, emphasize them, practice them. And you know, it's funny because I studied like crazy for those 3 weeks. Like I'd never studied before because if you in college or in school, like if you're taking a test, you kind of have, you know, if you're asking an equation or you're trying to remember a fact or something, you kind of have a few seconds to think about it. You can ponder it, whatnot. On Shark Tank, like everything you say can and will be used against you, right? It's like a court of law in there.
Right.
So you have to be on the tip of your tongue, like mm-hmm. emphasize every single word. So everything I said on the show was practiced. Every situation was rehearsed. The sharks didn't know that I was so rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't know what questions they were going to ask. So like, you know, it was really, you know, kind of jeopardy that like it was, you know, it was just, you know, they were asking whatever questions I'd be prepared.
Yeah.
But every single thing I said on that show, I had at least thought of before or memorized before. And so, you know, went on the show and went about 35 minutes on there and got a little bit of drama and came out with a deal with Robert Hirschbeck. I think we were asking for 5% for 50,000 and came back with a deal with Robert Hirschbeck for 10% for 100,000. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now, none of it mattered unless we were aired.
Okay.
Right? Now, the deal would go through. The deal went through anyways, but...
But it's more about the airtime and getting that exposure.
You can
than
raise money
else.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
You don't get shown in front of 8 million people where you are with the entertainment. I mean, you can buy an ad on television, right? Because nobody watches those. Uh-huh. They're tuning out during that. For Shark Tank, it's like a, you know, a 5 to 7 minute like infomercial basically on your business or people tuning in because you're the entertainment. You really can't buy media like that. Some company did a study where they said Shark Tank is worth like $4 million in media value.
Wow.
I don't think that's nearly accurate because even if you spent $4 million on advertising, you're not getting the attention of people.
Yeah.
You're advertising to them. Like Shark Tank, you are the entertainment.
Yeah, people who are tuning in want to see these businesses.
Exactly. So we were so lucky to be on that show. Incredibly grateful and lucky to just be on that show. It was really a game changer for Hungry Harvest.
And do you still work with him?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't talk with Robert regularly, but I talk with his group, the Hirschbeck group, pretty frequently. Yeah,
that's great. How accurately did they depict your episode?
Pretty accurately, actually. Yeah, I mean, it was about 6 minutes long. I think the actual segment was. I was up there for probably 35 minutes. You know, the part they don't show is all the sharks talking over each other to ask you questions. You got five people on there, all self-made millionaires and billionaires, all big personalities, right? All on TV, very curious about your business. Your job on Shark Tank is not to get a deal; it's to make sure you don't look like an idiot,
right?
Right. That's the whole point of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to make sure I did not look like an idiot. One sure way to make sure you look like an idiot is to piss off one of the sharks, to either ignore them or ignore their question. Or, you know. So if you have two sharks asking a question at once, who do you take a question through? like, I was not prepared for that at all. So I was like trying to divert my attention and try to like make eye contact all over the place. They didn't really show that part. They just showed, they kind of cut off a lot of answers. They cut off sharks. So it makes it seem like they're asking questions one at a time in very like orderly fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Not happening at all. It's chaos.
Right.
Absolute
okay.
chaos. It's very stressful. It's so stressful, in fact, that there's one person, I heard a story that one person actually passed out on the set. They didn't air that episode, but it was like, it is real pressure, man,
yeah.
on there. They actually have a psychologist that they employ that they have talked to people after the episode. It's really just to cover their own ass for
yeah.
insurance or anything, or something like that. But, you know, it's very stressful. You know, people go up there with their livelihood, with their projects, with their things that they've been spending, you know, 100 hours a week on for the past 5 years. And if the shark says one bad thing about it, then all of a sudden it can be ruined like that.
Yeah.
Whew. That's a lot of pressure. So, you know, luckily, like I said, we were lucky to be on the show and lucky I didn't look like an idiot.
Yeah.
And we're very grateful for it.
And so you said there was about six months in between air date and...
Yeah, something like that. 7 months.
How hard was it to not tell people the outcome?
Oh, my God. I didn't tell anybody I was on the show.
Oh.
So in the contract, like, you were zipped silent. The only people that knew what we got to deal with, Robert, between the time when we... filmed on the show in the time when we aired, probably about 10 people on the face of the planet, right? Well, maybe more than that, but like in my circles,
right.
like our company, my parents, I didn't even tell my grandma. I left my grandma out of the loop. She was like asking me, did you get a deal? I was like, I can't tell you because I was so, I mean, if word gets out or something like that, and you don't get aired, like, you know, what's the point?
Right. Why would yeah.
Why don't you just wait? So agonizing. You like want to tell, especially because I was doing this kind of weird project. All my friend, like when I started the business, all my friends were going out to cool cities and getting these big jobs and whatnot and doing these cool things. And I was living at home. My parents started a produce delivery service where I had no experience, wasn't making any money, was barely getting any traction. And so I wanted to, you know, like every 22-year-old, I wanted to like prove myself to my friends and have credibility and whatnot. And so like Shark Tank was that credibility for me. Like,
yeah.
That we actually did something cool. And to hold that secret in for like 6 months, ooh, agonizing. Absolutely agonizing.
I mean, I think anybody would be like, yeah, I was on national TV on like an extremely successful television show. And I was like actually on it, not just like an extra. Like,
yeah, yeah. No, I try to be, grateful about it. And
no, I mean, that's huge.
Humble, but it was definitely a really, really cool and humbling experience.
That's great.
To be on the show. It's
and
pretty
then
neat.
Were you on like a 40 under 40 of some kind?
Yeah, the Forbes, 30 under 30. I feel like everybody has 30 under 30s these days, but I was on Forbes, 30 under 30 in 2017.
Well, that's pretty impressive too. I mean, that's that's the original one, right? Like that's the one to be on.
Definitely appreciate it. I didn't make the rules. They chose me. So definitely appreciative of Forbes for putting me on the list. I don't know what I did, but it was pretty cool. To be recognized.
Yeah. So I imagine, you know, in your line of work, with the type of social impact you're trying to make, you see, do, and hear pretty meaningful and special things on a pretty frequent basis. Is there any moment, you know, while working at Hungry Harvest that really sticks out to you as something like incredibly impactful for you?
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many, man. That's a good question. I mean, one of them is actually today. Like, I, you know, it's our fifth birthday, and I sent out this email that, you know, basically that's said the premise of the email, you know, I spent past few birthdays sending out emails, basically, look at all our accomplishments of the past years. We're not, for this fifth birthday email I sent out, like, I want to focus on here's what we have yet to accomplish, all the projects we're working on, the vision, kind of building it out and looking at people. And, you know, one of our employees that actually I don't get to interact with too much because he just works for us on weekends and has a day job during the week. He sent me this really touching email about just of the culture we've built and like how, you know, the relationships he has don't feel disingenuous and they're real. People are really helping each other and, you know, people are there's not a lot of drama and people are like genuinely care about the mission. And it's humbling. It's honoring to be able to have that kind of impact on people and to know that, you know, that's kind of the culture we make. And you know, it's really cool to be able to come to an office and have people laugh and mm-hmm. have people, you know, bring their passion to work and genuinely care and you know, not work too hard. You know, people bust their ass for sure, but, you know, that people are not working. We, in the beginning days, we were working 80, 70 hour weeks. Today, you know, that's not really happening for a ton of people. So we've generally got a pretty good schedule going on, which is good, that, you know, we've got some structure. So that's just one example.
Yeah, of course.
Another example, I mean, it's really cool. We hear these comments all the time from produce and SNAP sites specifically, that just people are saying that they're a blessing and, like, kind of just thanking us for, you know, recognizing the opportunity and not overlooking some of these neighborhoods that, like I said before, people have just, nonprofits, organizations, for-profits, governments have just completely looked over, not poured resources in. It's really, you know, it's really fulfilling to be able to hear those comments. Obviously, we don't, you know, that's not the purpose of our work. It's not to, you know, be complimented all the time, right? But it's to impact people's lives. And I think that's really special. I mean, it's what I wanted to do since I was 12, 13 years old, is make difference. And it's cool to be able to come to work every day and know that we're doing that. You know, I always, whenever I need to pinch myself, I think of alternative realities. There's, you know, I always wanted to become an entrepreneur, but it was a distant dream for a very long time. For, like, I'm talking about like 8-9 years. I was like, I want to become an entrepreneur, but I'll probably just, you know, do a job or something, or get a job after college, please my parents, maybe I'll move out or something. And so it was always this kind of distant reality. It was never going to come true. And so whenever I have to pinch myself, I say, like, okay, so I'm sitting here, I'm 26 years old, I'm running a company that's, you know, 50 people and doing really fulfilling work, and we're growing like crazy, and we're doing really cool things. Like, what if I had just, like, taken a job somewhere, right?
Yeah.
How happy would I be? I don't think I'd be happy. I'd always be wondering, like, what entrepreneurship's like. And that's why I'm such a big advocate for, like, young people getting into entrepreneurship. Like, screw it. What do you, you know, you don't have much to lose, right? And you're just always going to wonder what it's going to be like. So, you know, I always play that game with myself of, like, putting myself in shoes of, like, what if I just took a job after college? Like, how happy I would be? Where would I be? So I'm really glad I made this choice. It's been really fulfilling, humbling journey.
And I don't think a lot of people would have taken that leap, but obviously, you know, you did, and you have created something that is still going 5 years later. I mean, most organizations definitely don't make it even that far, you know, like a lot of the time.
Yeah, like I said, I think, you know, not that my job's easy, but there are a lot harder jobs out there. You know, people that are picking produce for a living out in California that are making, you know, 10 cents for every stalk of celery that they harvest. That's a hard job, right? Mm-hmm. Or a mom that has three kids that's going out to be an entrepreneur. That's a tougher job. Or you know, if you're a person of color, if you're black, trying to raise money, it's a lot harder job, right? So I don't think my job's easy, but I always, you know, say hard work is relative. Right. And there's a lot harder workers or people that are riskier and have it a lot tougher than me out there. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, no, for sure. Right. So you mentioned that the first person that you were buying produce from was that farmer who came to your University of Maryland class.
That's right. Yep.
How did, obviously, I'm assuming you may or may not still communicate with them. You might buy produce from them. How did you find more people to buy produce from?
We went to, we did a lot of networking. We went to a ton of events. There's the agriculture industry and produce industry has lots and lots of events where they bring farmers, business people, wholesalers, packing houses together. There's a big one called the PMA, Produce Marketing Association Conference. It's like the people in the produce industry refer to it as their Super Bowl, right? It's like 20,000 people, 30,000 people or something. It comes once a year, and we go around, walk the floor, and make, you know, a few hundred contacts, and wind up buying from a dozen of them or so, or whatnot, something along those lines, and just network a lot of farmers and wholesalers. I mean, a lot of these businesses, a lot of these farmers have the same problem where they've got all this produce that's going to waste, and they want to find an outlet for it because they know it's perfectly good.
Yep.
On the farm, they refer to it as farmer's food because it's like good stuff that, you know, the number one retailers won't take. Just because the pepper is, you know, has green and red instead of just being green or just being red, or the eggplant's not perfect shape, or cucumber is a little bit curved, or kale stems are too soft. Like, we think those reasons are ridiculous why food would go to waste. And quite frankly, so do farmers. So they're happy to sell us produce even if it's at a discount because they're making their money back, making sure they're getting, you know, we do cost plus pricing for them. So make sure we're covering their costs plus a guaranteed profit margin on top of that. making sure everybody's making money. So trying to price it out fair. So that's a really the value right. proposition for them.
So I only have like one more question for you.
Yeah, what's up?
So what's the future of Hungry Harvest look like? What's in the agenda for, you know, 2020 and beyond?
Oh man, we got so many exciting things going on. We're about to launch a new tech platform where our website's going to be really mobile friendly. Customization's going to be a lot easier. It's going to allow us to add a lot of new product features. We're going to allow customers to choose their delivery days and delivery times, which you can't currently do. We're going to do all these different cool things on the customer features front. We're going to hire a bunch more. We've got 10 open positions right now. If anybody's listening to this podcast, lives in Baltimore, interested in working for Hungry Harvest, check out our careers page. We're always looking for people, passionate about food and from Baltimore, especially that like the same things as we do. Expanding to more cities. So we're in 6 cities, 9 states right now. We're thinking about moving to Charlotte, Atlanta, Tampa, Orlando, Boston, some of the cities kind of on our next list that we're looking at, later this year and early next year and whatnot. And really, we're going to continue to grow and, work with more farmers, make sure our produce is fresher. And it's kind of always a something we're constantly improving on. So we're really interested in making the consumer experience as best as we can and maximizing the value there, maximizing the value for our farmers and our suppliers, for our employees, our team. And the kind of we look at this business in the stakeholder model and the conscious capitalism view, where we're not existing just to make a profit. We don't look at businesses just businesses exist to make profits for the shareholders. We think profits are kind of a byproduct of adding value for all your 5 different stakeholders, right? The community, the buyers, the supplier, the customers, the suppliers, the employees, and the investors. So. That's kind of what we're doing. We're going to continue to add value to all 5 of those different stakeholders and have a good time doing it.
Great. And continue to grow and
yeah, man.
Be here in Baltimore City.
We're really excited about the city. I'm generally an optimist. I look at problems and say I want to solve them and don't say I look at problems and complain about them. So
right.
Let's try to make Baltimore one better, one apple at a time. That's what we say.
Let's do it. All right. Evan, thanks so much for speaking with us today. If anybody has any follow-up questions or wants to learn more, they can visit your website, right?
Hungryharvest.net. That's right. All right. And maybe we can get a discount code out there, too. I think you can sign up the code probably Baltimore10. Sign up with the discount code Baltimore10. I'll get you a discount.
Yeah, and I'll reach out to you before this episode comes out, and we'll put that or anything else maybe in the description of the podcast.
Cool.
All Sounds right. Good. Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Charm City. If you are interested in being interviewed, or if you're a local business interested in sponsoring us, please reach out to charmcitypod@gmail.com.